Hey, everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome to another episode of The Journal. If this is your first time here, I want to say thanks for downloading and appreciate you joining us for this episode. We got a great guest on the show today, Ryan Hoover, who is the founder and CEO of Product Hunt. If you're in the tech scene, you definitely know Product Hunt. If you are not in the tech scene, but you have an idea for a product, you want to know about Product Hunt, what it does, and how to best use it to your advantage. But first, if you are new to the journal and this is your first time here, thanks for downloading. But also, I wanted to tell you about our newsletter. So I send out a newsletter the first day of every month, and it is packed full of all kinds of good information. I spend a ton of time going in and looking at, probably close to 100 different articles. And these articles can range from kind of productivity hacks to stuff about Japanese culture and meditation, fine spirits, really cool apps, all different types of really odd things. We actually call it the newsletter for the curious. So there's bound to be something in there. I typically post about 6 or 7 different articles per newsletter. There's bound to be something in there that you'll find really compelling and enjoy. So check it out. Like I said, this isn't one of those newsletters that you sign up for and you get a bunch of spam and, you know, it ends up coming every day or once a week. I only send this once a month. So the open rate, I'm actually really proud of the open rate. The open rate is right around 70%. Most newsletters out there are around 15%. So the folks that do receive it really enjoy it. We're close to right around 70,000 people now reading the newsletter. So head on over to thejournal.email. You can go there in your browser or on your phone. Put in your email address there, confirm it, and I'll get you an old issue so you can check it out right away. And then you just sit back and relax and wait for the next month to come around, and boom, there's a new issue in your inbox and tons of good stuff for you to check out. Anyway, that's thejournal.email. Sign up over there. So today's guest, as I mentioned, Ryan Hoover, he is the creator of Product Hunt. Product Hunt is a social product website that allows its individual community members to come in and submit new products and then vote on them, and the best ones kind of surface to the top. Reminds me of a site that I made back in the day. But this is dedicated just to products. So you find all types of interesting apps and new product launches. They could be physical products. They could be everything from podcasts. They could be new tech gear. So as you'd imagine, Ryan runs the site and it's really popular. You know, I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm assuming it's millions of people at this point actually go there to try and find the latest gear. And so he sees a lot of stuff. So we get into it and chat about kind of all the cool stuff that he's finding these days. And also, if you ever have your own idea, you'll want to learn how to kind of get it to the top of the front page. We talk about some of those tricks and tips as well. So anyway, enjoy the interview. Ryan's an awesome guest, and I'll see you back at the end of the episode. How'd you come up with the idea for Product Hunt?
Yeah, so Product Hunt initially was just me and my friends sharing cool new apps, products, and services we found. The initial idea was, the inspiration really was, we were already doing this on text messaging, and we had a Telegram group with a bunch of people in tech that we'd share, hey, check out this app, it's cool, it's fun. And I realized that there was no single place on the internet, just a list of here's what's new and cool in tech. You see it on Twitter, you see it on like TechCrunch and other publications, but I just wanted a list of cool stuff to try.
Were you a Reddit user back then? I mean, obviously, Digg was no longer tech for a very long time. Mm-hmm. It had only been tech for like 3 months when we first launched. I don't know if you knew that, but it was almost all tech.
Yeah.
There were subreddits for that, though. Didn't you think like, oh, there's a subreddit for this? Why should I build this?
Yeah, I actually have not ever really been an active daily kind of Reddit user. I've admired it, and occasionally I'll jump into the internet of, what is it called? The internet is beautiful is one of my favorite subreddits. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because it is kind of surfacing interesting gems on the internet, a lot of them products. But I never found a subreddit that attracted me and it became a place where it kind of had this type of content. The culture of Reddit is also kind of very different than product discovery. Reddit's about, you know, anything on the internet, really.
Right.
And everything from cat gifts, which I love, to products, to opinions. And I wanted something very focused on here's cool stuff in technology.
And was this, at some point, did you think, okay, there's a business to be built here? Or was it just still with a friend, like, let's just put up a simple little site and just see what happens?
Yeah, well, it actually didn't even start as a site. It started off as an email list mm-hmm. in the very beginning. And, you know, I'm a product manager by trade and have experience in like a very super light website building, but I'm not a programmer, not an engineer. And so I was forced to really figure out, okay, how do I launch something without, you know, either spending months and months learning how to code or paying a developer to build something.
Right.
So an email list is how we started. And that gave me enough validation and kind of proof that people like this got more and more subscribers on the service.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course we hit a point where, okay, email's cool and it's useful and it's a great way to become part of someone's daily habit, but you can't really interact. You can't comment. There's very limited options within that format. So that email then turned into a website, which was a side project for about 5 months, really, until we incorporated.
And then were you in the Bay Area at this time or?
Yeah. I moved to San Francisco in 2010 and worked at a startup for about 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. It was kind of in between.
What was that startup?
It's called Playhaven.
Okay.
So it's very well known in the gaming space. We were essentially building tools for game developers. So I was a product manager there and building a lot of different ways to target advertising, cross promotion, in-app purchasing, that kind of stuff.
Were you doing this kind of nights and weekends kind of thing or?
Well, I actually, in 2013 is when I started, this is about 3 years into being in the startup. We're, you know, went from 10 people to about 100, doing really well, but I felt like I was getting a little bit bored of working in gaming. I didn't feel, frankly, as challenged as I could be. And so it was at that point, I kind of transitioned to a part-time role. And that part-time role is when I started Product Hunt and experimenting with different ideas.
Okay. So you still have a little bit of income coming in. It's always tough for founders, I feel, especially in the Bay Area, because, you know, rents here are just insane. And how do you make that jump? I always try and figure this out because there's so many people that, and I'm sure you get this too, they kind of come up to you and they're like, I got this great idea. I want to go launch something, blah, blah, blah. But I have, you know, I'm paying $4,000 in rent or whatever it may be.
I have a month of runway. Yeah. If you leave a company. I mean, I was super, super fortunate in that my boss and the team said, hey, Ryan, instead of just leaving and, you know, foregoing your salary, why not just like work part time? So 20 hours a week and we'll cut your salary in half.
Yeah.
And so that gave me enough to tread water in San Francisco for a while.
Right.
And gave me time to figure things out. I wasn't actually leaving to start a company per se. It wasn't like I need to start a company and that's what I have to do. But I was actually interviewing in a few different startups. But I was just fortunate to be in that position. I actually think I wish there were more opportunities to give people that kind of flexibility and freedom.
Well, that's kind of why you have accelerators now, right? Like they give you a little bit of cash, you can kind of get off the ground. Not being a developer though, like how do you even go about finding your first engineer? Because you can really get screwed there, right? You can hire some mediocre talent and have, you know, like, what did you do?
I just feel like I'm so fortunate in different ways that things kind of just worked out in many ways. So the beginning, it was me and my friend Nathan Bashaw, and started the email list. And then I emailed him some weeks after that and said, hey, Nathan, I want to turn this email list into a website. I'm thinking about a few different options. Like, should I learn Ruby on Rails? Like, what should I do to build this? And he's like, hey, I have some time over Thanksgiving break. I'll be bored at my parents' place. Do you want to work on it together? And so him and I, for about 5 months, 4 or 5 months, worked on it on the side. And that was enough to get something off the ground and get some traction. But then after that, he ended up moving to New York, where you are now. And focusing full time at like General Assembly, and ended up connecting then with Andreas, who is our CTO. He at the time was in Vienna, and I was just lucky to one, have him excited about working on this with me, but two, also being a very connected, talented engineer product person. I mean, if it weren't for Andreas, we wouldn't have as good of an engineering team at all. And I won't pretend to be able to evaluate like technical skills. I have to rely on other people for that really.
Now you went from, you know, making this jump from email list to actual website. Talk to me a little bit about how you grew that audience, because that's obviously the biggest challenge for almost every startup is, okay, you have something awesome. You want to tell the world about it. You know, you probably have 20, 30 friends that you can tell about it and get on that list, and they're stoked, maybe.
Yeah.
And, but how do you grow that?
Or they pretend to be.
Exactly. Yeah. How do you grow that to hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people? Any kind of key takeaways there?
Yeah, I guess one thing is that we were building a product for ourselves and for people like us in the very beginning. So it wasn't that we were building a product or a service for people in elderly homes or people that we couldn't directly relate to as much. And so by doing that, I could get a lot of the initial user base were my friends and people that I knew. And then, of course, you always have to take into account your friends are not going to tell you the truth. Sometimes they're not going to tell you, some of the harsh, real, honest feedback. But, you know, after we got to a couple hundred email subscribers and then 1,000 people and 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, a lot of it then grew just through the community in tech. So that's what we focused on initially, is a very clearly focused on people who are into tech, who want to discover new things, and many of them makers, founders, people who are launching products themselves. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it was just kind of like through a lot of manual things, like literally emailing people that signed up on the site and welcoming them, all hand done emails, like not automated.
Crazy. So you would just sit there and, okay, 20 people signed up today or 50 people, and you would send individual emails to each of those folks.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I should probably look back and see how many emails I was sending, but I would look and see who was signing up. I would use, I forget which tool I was using, but it would pull in social information about that person, like where they worked, and if I was connected to them. And I would email them just really simple stuff like, oh, like someone at Techstars would sign up and be like, oh, Techstars, okay, interesting. That's kind of the audience and the type of community I want to reach out to. I just email them a super short note, say, hey, if you have feedback, let me know. I'd love to hear anything, because we're starting off really early. Your feedback's important.
It's crazy because most people would think, okay, you can just like, you know, there's Zendesk, you can just automate all that stuff or whatever. Yeah. And you went and did this all manually. That's pretty awesome.
Because people understand and recognize the authenticity and like the real human element. Like people, especially in technology, like they see the intercom automated emails from the CEO saying, so glad you signed up. And it doesn't feel quite as authentic.
Yeah.
Now I don't do that anymore, just because there's a point where these tactics and these things early on are super important and useful, but then they just certainly don't scale. Like,
that's right.
And our team's time is spent better else doing something that has a bigger, like more scalable impact. Sometimes you have to do stuff like that to get started.
That's what, I get emailed and actually sent physical products from time to time. And I always really appreciate those handwritten notes where a founder will take the time, and you can tell it's not just stamped out. They mentioned something, why it might be relevant to you and things like that. I'm sure you get a lot of that type of stuff as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, you probably started getting some growth as well from founders at some point. They were telling their friends to go and sign up to vote their products up, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a big thing for us at Dig as well. We'd get people wanting to promote their stuff.
Yeah.
Did you see a lot of people trying to kind of hack the system and create fake accounts? And did you ever run into any of that? Or
yeah, I'm sure we probably ran into very similar things that you ran into at Dig as well. And yeah, in the beginning, there was a time when it was just me and a part-time developer in Italy that I got connected to from another friend. And this was pre-funding. I didn't have much money, so it's like kind of all I could afford. And I would wake up in the morning, and also like no one else is watching the site. I was a community manager. And so I'd wake up and see about 8 hours of things that happened on Product Hunt that no one else is watching. And sometimes they would be clearly fake accounts or bots. And there's this one time where it was like every morning, it was like, 8 bots would upvote 4 things. And I was like, why is this happening? It's not like they're making a big impact on the site.
Right.
But they're just really annoying me. And I would have to manually delete each upvote, which took about 10 seconds per upvote, because we just didn't have the tools to detect it, nor to like do this in bulk. It was really stressful, but eventually, you know, we built more sophisticated systems for that.
Yeah, that's a nightmare. Especially when you're, as the founder, it sounds like we went down the same path where when you're first getting started, you're wearing like 5 different hats, like, you know, your community manager, your technical support, like all these.
Yeah.
Did you find that was kind of the case for you, where when you're first getting going, you have to do all these different roles?
Yeah. Cause you can't hire from day one, like 5 different people to do all that stuff. You also, your product and everything is evolving too. So you don't know really where you're going to need those people or what areas of the product you might need to scale. For me, I like the social interaction. I like discovering products. I like writing about products. So a lot of the things that I did, I just naturally enjoy and would do for zero money. Mm-hmm. For me, it wasn't a challenge. It was just more of, okay, there's a grind to it a little bit. You just have to, I guess, like it to some degree.
Yeah. At what point did you say this is actually a real business and could be much bigger? So I'm going to go raise some venture capital.
Yeah. So this is like a big question too, especially being in Silicon Valley. You have people who feel pressure to raise money. A lot of, like, let's say an engineer from Facebook or Dropbox or wherever, they leave that company with an idea. And mm-hmm. a lot of times they'll have VC saying, hey, take our money. Like, I know you're pre-product, take our money, go figure it out. And that can be really enticing for people even before they have, you know, something that's working. For me, it was about 4 or 5 months in. I was at that crossroads where I'm like, okay, there's a bunch of different ideas I was exploring. One of them was, okay, let's raise money, build a team, scale everything, move faster. Another one was, I don't know if I've talked about this publicly, but this idea around, what if we actually made it entirely open source and basically had the community build the product itself? And what would that look like? How would you structure an organization?
Like a WordPress style, just all open source, but you're kind of still at the head, more or less trying to influence the decisions, but you don't necessarily know where it's going to go.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about that. I was like, how many companies have executed that successfully? And it was an interesting direction, because being a community-based product, having the community build it itself is a lot of value, but also is very risky. So long story short, I met with a bunch of people. Gary Tin was at the time, Y Combinator, was one of the first people I had an honest conversation about. I was like, hey, Gary, we have a bunch of traction.
Was a bunch of traction? You said a bunch of at this point, like, how many users, how many page views a day are you doing? What do you consider to be like, okay, maybe I should raise some money, this is a thing?
Yeah. Yeah. By a bunch, it was not like in the millions of users at all. I think at that time it was probably, I wish I remember the exact numbers. It might've been 10,000 people visiting the site a day. Not very many, but mm-hmm. it was consistent growth. If you looked week over week over week, it was consistent growth over the past several months. And so it wasn't like a flash in the pan where overnight 10,000 people were on the site. Now it's worthwhile. But
were VCs starting to use the site at that point? Because I know that was a big mm-hmm. tipping point for you, kind of like all of a sudden all the venture community was looking to your front page to find new investments.
Yeah, it was. And again, I was looking at who was signing up too.
Right.
And I remember when you signed up, I can't remember. I probably emailed you at some point. I should dig up the email. I can't remember exactly, but like when you sign up, or like people like MG Siegler or other investors, these are people I'd been following on Twitter or knew from a distance. And that was one, it was like some social proof for the community in tech. Like, here are all these people whose job is to find cool new products, and they're using Product Hunt and signing up and participating in some way. That was a good signal to the community that this was interesting. And it's very different than like a VC signing up for some, like, you know, new app for teenagers. Cause mm-hmm. like that target demographic is very different.
Right.
We were actually directly targeting VCs and people in technology. So it was a good signal. And then, I was just at that point where got some traction, got some really interesting people on board using the site. And then it was Gary that I was just having the honest conversation with, like, should we go through YC? Should we raise money? Should we just work on this on the side and turn it into like a lifestyle business with, you know, very minimal cost, but maybe making 20K a month or something? Mm-hmm. Obviously we went with the VC route and scaled it from there.
Yeah. So you scaled it up, you launched, you've done a ton of different iterations on the product itself over the years, adding mm-hmm. new areas to vote up, all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah.
What do you see on the site that gets you really excited these days? Because you see a lot of trends before anyone else, right? I mean, I think mm-hmm. that you start to see them emerge. Like, bots was a big thing. You had a whole dedicated section for that.
Yep.
Like, let's go down a couple of them. What do you think of bots?
Well, I think...
Are you a member of the Christmasina bot?
Yes.
It seems like everybody had their own bot for a second.
I think there's a future where maybe probably everyone has some sort of AI bot assistant service of some sort,
like a way to like answer incoming requests for you. Or
I haven't personally experimented with a lot of them, partly because they're not as sophisticated as they could be. But I know, like, Chris and my friend Sandy McPherson, she created Sandy Bot, And if you text it, like, where are you? It'll basically respond. It'll respond back with a general, like, it won't say exactly where she is, because that's a little bit like
stalkery.
Yeah. But it'll say like, she's in this general area, and link you to Google Maps and like have a little radius. Mm-hmm. She has like some Easter eggs in it too. So I think those are really interesting.
Those are fun, but they're not a real thing, right? Those are just fun little utilities.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you see anything real there?
I've seen a lot of people translate web experiences into bot or chat interfaces, and it doesn't actually make it better. It actually makes it a worse experience. Like booking a flight, for example, it's like, okay, I have to type all these, like, how many keystrokes do you have to type to say, I want to find a flight next week from LAX to SFO,
right,
or vice versa. It's just actually super laborious. So
the only benefit there is you're not like upsold like cars and hotels and everything else.
Yeah. Well, not yet.
Not yet. That's right.
Yeah. Not yet. So I'm seeing a lot of people experimenting with it, but I'm not seeing a lot of actual bots that I use. Actually, on Twitter, I sent out a poll maybe 3 months ago, and obviously I have a more tech focused audience. Sent out a poll saying, hey, do you use any Facebook Messenger bots? And I think 90%+ said no. Like, I don't use any.
I don't use a single one.
And I can't, and that's not to say that like there isn't a future in that space at all, but
maybe it is.
Maybe.
Maybe there is no future in that space.
So I think, what do you think about, I think what's more interesting is voice, and a lot of these bots and conversational interactions are actually much better off in a voice interface.
I agree with that. Yes.
Do you use Alexa or Google Home or anything?
Yeah. I have both of them at home. Yeah. You know, I set many a kitchen timers with them.
Yes.
That's a great use case. When I put my beer in the freezer, I tell it to remind me in 15 minutes. Like,
oh yeah.
You know, there's little things like that. But, you know, there's not, for me, there has to be that aha moment where I'm like, oh my God, mm-hmm. I'm never going back, and my life has changed for the mm-hmm. better. Right. And kitchen timers don't quite do it for me yet.
Yeah.
And you know, yes, it's great to know how the Warriors did last night when I wake up in the morning, if I didn't catch the game, you mm-hmm. know, and that's fun. But, I like all the integrations, and I think the light stuff is kind of cool, turning off and on lights and things like that. But mm-hmm. but there's no kind of like life-changing moment where you're mm-hmm. just like, this I can't go back. Do you have one of those yet? Or
I wouldn't say it's life-changing, but a couple of weeks ago I had this this really awesome experience with Google Home, which basically just launched. It's still super early, and I was about to get on a flight to fly to LA. And I was like, I wonder if Google Home knows that I'm flying. So I said, hey, Google, is my flight on time? That's all I said. No context, just is my flight on time? And it looked through my email, is what I assume, because it knows like the Southwest
or your calendar or whatever.
Yeah. Or calendar, something. And it said, yes, Ryan, your flight is on time. Flight 2X, I don't know what it was, 2133 is on time for LAX at 2:10. And I was like, oh my gosh, how did it know? I mean, I know how it knew, but it was this delightful experience where I asked it a question that I would normally ask a human. Mm-hmm. Like if I was, you know, back when I was a kid, when I was asking like my mom, I would ask my mom like that same kind of question if we're flying together. So I thought that was really interesting because it knew information about me. It took a lot less time than opening up my email or searching Google and typing in all these numbers and letters. The friction from question to answer was just super short.
Yeah, I love those types of experiences. The issue that I have is I'm still in the probably 80 to 90% failure where I ask it a really, you know, complex question. And just like, I have no idea, Kevin. And you're just like, well, why do I want to try that again? You know, mm-hmm. so you forget to ask it questions. And then you watch a commercial and it's like, Google, do this for me. And you're like, wow, it can do that. Yeah. You know, it kind of reminds you to go back and try new questions because new data is coming online all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was doing that the other day where for the longest time, so, you know, I'm a huge Warriors fan, but live mm-hmm. out on the East Coast now. So I miss half the games because it's mm-hmm. just too late. And I just want to know how individual players are doing. Mm-hmm. And so I can't remember if it was Alexa or Google because I have them side by side to compete with each other. And I asked one of them how did Curry do last night, and it gave me the stats from the night prior. Mm. But that wasn't the case just like 2 months ago. So they're finally hooking up these additional data streams, which is cool. But I think it's going to be a few more years. But I agree with you in the sense that the bots thing is a lot better in terms of voice. I think mm-hmm. that's really cool.
Yeah.
I started really wearing my Apple Watch as well. recently, and I'm kind of hooked on it. I actually turned off every single notification. I don't get one notification on my Apple Watch, and I love it. It's the best.
So it's a watch.
It's got my workout data on the front there.
Okay.
So I can kind of see, like, you know, calories burned, minutes, hours active, things like that, temperature outside, date, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's useful. But then I can ask it questions. I can just hold in the crown and just be like, Siri, tell me about this, you know, mm-hmm. and Siri, we all know, is horrible, but it works sometimes. So, yeah. You know, I like having the voice there on the wrist, which is quite nice.
What do you think of the AirPods?
I love them.
Yeah.
I love the AirPods. Yeah. I forget they're my ears. I just wear them everywhere. And like my wife will be, Dario will just be like, you have them in, like we're sitting at dinner. Like, you know, like, do you have a pair as well?
I did buy a pair. At first, I did not like them.
Why?
And so here's the reason. So at first, I started asking Siri questions because I'm like, oh, I've seen the movie Her. I want to like talk to a robot.
I don't talk to Siri.
And so that was my first time experience, is this assumption or this expectation that, oh, I'm going to be able to talk to Siri and it's going to be great. It's going to be like Google Home. And Siri is awful. One is too inconsistent, or two, it's too slow. You ask a question and it's like thinking and it's waiting and it's probably talking to the internet or something. And so that was my first experience in my kind of context. And then I started ignoring Siri entirely. I don't think I've used Siri with AirPods since then.
Yeah.
And I started thinking of just headphones, just wireless headphones.
That's right.
And then I'm like, I love these.
Oh, exactly. Great. Well, so you know, you can go into settings and turn off the Siri functionality. I actually did that.
Yeah.
So now when I double tap on the side of my ear, it just pauses it. You know, you can set to play pause versus activate Siri.
Oh, that's great.
You know, you can also just remove one earbud and it pauses it too.
Yeah.
I like the fact that there's no wires. I can have that little charger in my pocket. It's actually not too big. You know, they're pretty awesome.
Yeah. It's just, there's a lot of delightful things about it. Even the syncing is like magical. And I know that's like very cheesy to say nowadays and cliche, but I just like open up the box and my phone just said, hey, I see the AirPods nearby. I want to sync. And I was like, wow, that was so easy.
It's really crazy. And to think that that's probably the best product Apple's put out in the last few years is like wireless.
Yeah.
So let's jump back to other products. So bots were both kind of like, what do you think about VR?
VR, I think VR inevitably will change a lot of industries and user behavior. I think we're still obviously very super early in it becoming like a mainstream mass consumer thing.
Do you have a pair? What do you got? Oculus?
I don't. Well, I got a pair from F8 last year, a Samsung Gear and Samsung kind of headset.
Yeah.
But it's super low quality and it's just not to the point where I see myself like being immersed in the experience. So yeah, I mean, I think we're still a ways from it becoming kind of one of those mainstream things, but I mean, the use cases are endless. Like even when you think about how it might affect Airbnb, like what does Airbnb look like when you have VR? Like being able to potentially go inside of a home and check it out and see it rather than doing these weird spherical photos that you see like online in 2D.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of interesting travel use cases, commerce also. We were half joking around what would Product Hunt VR look like? Like if you basically created a virtual like store where you could go in and explore products and all these things, almost as if you were in like real life.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone will agree that it will change industries dramatically. It's just a matter of when, in my opinion. What do you think?
Yeah. I came out like a year and a half ago and I did a Medium post how I thought it was just stupid.
Oh, really? I missed that.
Yeah. I did a post because here's my take. Clearly the last year and a half or 2 years or whenever the first headsets started coming out, the mixture of hardware power and wearability, it's the hardware power is there, but it's in terms of like a massive water-cooled desktop PC sitting next year. Like that's, my mom's not going out and buying a water-cooled PC to get a VR in her house, right? So we know we're not there yet. You have like 1,000 cables like hooked up to your head and you know, you're tripping over them while you're trying to walk around.
Sensors around your room.
Yeah, it's bad. It's not bad tech. It's very early tech. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then on the flip side, I get the new Google Pixel phone and I throw it inside the sweater headset. What's that called?
Google Cardboard?
No, the one that feels like a sweater.
Oh, I don't know.
It came out with the Pixel.
You know? Oh, Daydream.
Daydream. That's right. Yeah.
I didn't. Yeah, I've never heard anyone describe it as a sweater.
No, it's made out of like it's made out of like sweats.
You ever haven't played with it?
Oh yeah, so it's just like sweats. Oh, cool. It's actually quite comfortable.
Sweats for your eyes.
Yeah. So yeah. I thought they did a good job with the design of the sweat headset. But I put it on, and you know, like the Samsung, it's like, you know, being in Pong, it's like super pixelated and old school. And, you know, yes, there are new cables, but it's just not a good experience. So, you know, the other thing though, that really bugs me is that I feel like there has been there has to be this kind of order of magnitude improvement over existing technology in order to really convince someone that this is a necessity they have to have in their daily life. And it is clearly not there yet, right? And we had the same issue with, and I know people hate it when I actually wrote this in the blog post, and people hate it when I compare it to these things, but you know, the Wii remote, right? It was like fun for a minute. We all got up, we all played tennis, we all swung it. And then at the end of the day, we're just like, oh, you know, actually I just want to sit down and have a controller. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And the same thing with like 3D TV, right? We all had the goggles. I slid my little tiny batteries in there.
I never fell into the 3D TV.
I fell into the 3D TV. I put it in and I watched Star Wars. I was like, oh, this is cool. And then guess what? It ran out of batteries and they were sitting in a drawer. And I'm like, do I really want to go buy those weird little disc watch batteries to like, no, I don't. So it just, you know, it gets sold. So I just, again, coming back to like, where is that thing that when I put this on, and I believe in the wow experience, because I've been in the Oculus and all these where you see like the whale like swimming by and it's like, wow, this would be really cool if I like smoked a joint and did this or something, right? But it's like, it's not outside of that initial experience, there's nothing that makes me, like every friend that I've had come over to my house and try out my VR is like, oh my gosh, that was so much fun. And then, you know, I'll talk to them two, three weeks later and I'm like, oh, you're going to get one? No, not really. Like that was fun. But so it's going to be years. It's going to be years out. I hope, I think sports will be a big one. I think if I could sit courtside and just watch a really cool game. AR, I think, is going to be, if they can get the tech right, I think the augmented reality side of things could be even a lot more fun and less kind of like fully immersive in the sense that I have to like not look around me. Like we're not going to be sitting, I don't feel like I'm ever going to go over to someone's house and we're all going to have headsets on and we're going to be sitting around like drinking beers with headsets on. Like it's just, it's antisocial. That was the other thing.
It's like BYOB.
Exactly. That was the weird thing about, that's the other thing about VR is I think a lot about consumer behavior, especially in company. And I think that every time that you sit there with a VR unit on, your friends just sit around and watch you kind of dance around and like poke at things that aren't there.
And put you on Snapchat, embarrassingly.
They do. Yeah. They do. I've had friends do that to me. And so it's like, gosh, there's just too many things, too many hurdles for it to get over. So I'm avoiding all investments in the space, and I'll probably be proven wrong and not, you know, some investors will make billions off of this thing, but I think it's early days and I'm holding out. I'm holding out for a few more years. So
yeah,
it sounds like we're saying the same thing. Like you just got to have to give it time and a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, there's a lot of hurdles right now from a cost perspective, but even just a UX perspective. It's kind of like bots and VR in very similar, areas. They're very nascent. There's a huge opportunity there, but we don't know exactly what it looks like or what it's going to be. So you see a bunch of people playing with different ideas and things like that.
Yeah. How does someone get something to the very top of Product Hunt? If someone, what ideas do you think resonate with people? Is there a certain kind of, and that's actually probably a horrible question because you don't want people creating me too products, right? Do you find that it's really the novel stuff that really kind of like breaks out, or what's hot right now?
Yeah, there's kind of a few different themes. There's sometimes the novel things, which are like going way back. Actually, this guy named Ethan built an app to message Ethan, basically an app just to message him. And that was silly and interesting and kind of going back to our conversation about like having your own bot. There was something strange and cool about that. So you see novel, interesting, silly things pop up. But things like Yo, yeah, where it's like, what? So it's an app, you tap a button and it says Yo to a friend. That's strange. And people are curious, like very similar to how people are curious about anything in media, like new TV show, new movie, new song. Like tech is the same kind of thing. People are curious. There's a cultural kind of meme aspect to new apps and products. And then there's products that like help you do better in your life. Actually, that's a theme that we see consistently on Product Hunt, whether it's a tool to make you a better designer, a tool for your like ongoing like day-to-day development as an engineer. Sometimes it's people are very curious to learn new things. So things that help them learn and become smarter or more educated actually do really well. And I think that's just, that's also one starting point for a lot of makers or founders is like, okay, how do I make a thing in my life more efficient or how do I become better at X? Mm-hmm. I think is a good place to start. And so we see a lot of people gravitate towards those specific types of products.
It feels like those are a lot of great lifestyle businesses. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, like every few years, we see a new trend pop up that is just like, it's going to change the entire landscape or it's going to be, you know, it's own thing. Like cryptocurrency mm-hmm. was a great example. When Bitcoin came out, everyone was like, holy hell, like this is a whole new thing, a whole new way to look at things.
Yeah.
You know, outside of like the personal improvement stuff, are you seeing any like, holy hell, like this is a new thing, or is that just like you just kind of have to wait and sit on the sidelines and those only happen once in a blue moon?
Yeah, there's like if you look at the transformational platform shifts, there's, you know, everything from like going, let's go to the desktop. You know, you had this computer that sat in your home. Then you also had the laptops. Now these computers are more portable. And then the biggest shift in the past decade-ish has been like mobile, of course, has changed the way that we interact with each other and technology dramatically. We still haven't gotten to that point. Like what's the next thing after mobile that's going to change the way like supplant the existing competitors or people that, you know, have already captured your attention? Like what's going to, I hate to use the word disrupt, but I'm just going to use it anyway. Like what's going to disrupt Facebook or Instagram, all these big players today,
right,
which most of their adoption and usage is on mobile today. And going back to the voice conversation, I think that's one of the more interesting spaces in the next 5-ish years is to think through, okay, going back to my Google Home experience, I actually use Google Home to play music more than I use it on my own computer when I'm at home. So instead of opening up Spotify and typing a bunch of keys to find like mm-hmm. Rufus the Soul, I can just be like, hey, Google, play Rufus the Soul, and done. It starts playing. And so that's actually shifted my behavior already in that particular use case.
That's interesting. So that's actually taking away from your mobile consumption. So they're losing active like impressions and unique users to voice.
Exactly.
But even though their APIs are still firing because they're actually serving the music, they're just not seeing it through the front end.
Yeah. What I do find interesting is that you're absolutely right. It's like taking away usage and engagement on an existing platform like mobile. And if you look at Google also, Google's majority of their money and where they're actually generating revenue is through search. And these are through, paid search posts when you search for something and people see those and they click on those and that's how they make money. What I find fascinating is that Google Home today has no ads, no direct monetization. And so in some ways they're cannibalizing their own revenue source by searching through Google Home. I'm not seeing those ads, but I'm still getting my answers. And so if overnight, let's say tomorrow, everyone stopped using googlesearch.com or on their mobile device and started using Google Home for all their search queries, they'd destroy themselves. They would make no money. So they have an interesting challenge, not only to become part of this future, but also to figure out how do you make money in a voice interface, voice experience.
Wow, that's a great point. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
You're right, because if you think about intent is what you're talking about, right? You have an intent for something and that's mm-hmm. how they make their money. Mm-hmm. And Amazon is just like, you know, Alexa, get me that, you know, dishwashing soap. And then
Oh my gosh.
Wow. I don't know if you guys heard that at home, but Alexa just responded. And I think we just got some soap coming.
There's no voice authentication. Mike's getting some new dishwashing soap.
That's so funny. We're at my buddy's house and I think he's getting some new soap now. I mean, you can see, Amazon's making money there, mm-hmm. but Google's not. Well, this is the same problem they have with apps though, right? Because apps are just individual silos of information. And so, I'm not searching for these things anymore. I know where to go. If I want to get food, I go to Postmates or mm-hmm. one of the 5 other apps. I don't think to search Google for that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. I feel like that more and more that's happening. I'm scared. Obviously that's like the bulk of their revenue. So mm-hmm.
at the same time, they're also capturing more Google's in a position to know more about you than Amazon today, because I mean, if you use Gmail, Google Calendar, they have a lot of data, just Google Analytics across the internet. They're obviously indexing everything. So Google is in a unique position to have a competitive advantage against Amazon and Alexa because it has access to data that Amazon, at least today, doesn't have access to. Amazon's unique competitive advantage is the commerce piece, of course.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of data there.
There's certainly a lot of data, but Amazon doesn't know that I'm flying, let's say, to right. LAX as one example. So it's going to be an interesting battle between these two companies.
And yeah.
Of course, Apple as well.
That's right. Anything else, or you think that those are kind of the big areas where you see things going? Any other little outliers there, or is that the kind of voice is the main focus right now?
For me, that's what I'm most excited about. I mean, I can also say like AR and everything is also really interesting and mm-hmm. exciting. Spectacles are a really super smart first step in that direction because they're, you know, very accessible, affordable compared to like Google Glasses back in like, I don't know, when was that? 2012?
Something like that. Yeah. Scoble ruined that one.
Scoble's fault.
That one photo of him in the shower with the glass.
Yeah. I've been seeing the two comparisons of like Scoble's shower photo and the spectacles, like marketing photos, like very different.
That's right.
You know, it's also, there's a whole other conversation that we could go into or not around like, you know, Snapchat and LA Tech and
What do you think about that? What do you think about Snapchat and actually also in Instagram, you know, taking a lot of their features and functionality? Like that seems to be, you know, I remember just, I don't know, a few years ago, it was kind of a big deal if you took someone's feature. Mm-hmm. People would get really pissed and be like, oh, they're just copying, blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. And I see both sides because, you know, Instagram is arguing that this is just a new way to consume media. Mm-hmm. Just like we invented the feed. Mm-hmm. Like this is a new type of feed. But, you know, obviously Snap kind of like created that way to consume media.
Yeah.
Are you seeing a lot of this kind of like more, I'm just going to copy the best of these features and put them into my product?
Yeah. Well, there's a recent article I read highlighting some of the challenges that crowdfunded companies are running into. In that there'll be a company that's, I think one of them that was referenced was the Fidget Cube. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
It's a silly kind of cube that you have in your desk. And some people like to play with their hands or fidget with something while they're like concentrating. Mm-hmm. And so it's a silly toy, got a bunch of backing on Kickstarter. And then some Chinese or some company or some other person just launched something exactly like it through like Chinese manufacturing, cheaper and faster than before they could release the product.
I heard about that.
And so there is this interesting challenge because hardware and physical products is becoming easier to build those, just like software as well. You're seeing this like validation happen through Kickstarter or crowdfunding, and then that product doesn't launch for another year. Meanwhile, someone else is like, wow, a lot of people seem to want this thing. I should build it.
Yeah.
And they're just copying and ripping them off.
Entirely. Yeah. See, this is challenging for me because I'm working on another app here. I mentioned on Instagram, I'm building a really simple meditation app because it's just been something I've been personally passionate about for a few years now. And I see a couple of things that I just don't exist. And there's a lot of great stuff out there. I love Headspace. I love Calm. A lot of great apps for this. But, you know, I have my own little take and I think it's unique and I want to build it out. And let people use it. And I was going to do this thing where I was going to do a private group, like invite people in, they could see the entire process, like the wireframing, like the initial designs, you know, I'd shoot a video every week and show people the behind That's the cool. scenes. I thought it'd be pretty cool. Yeah. Right. But then I was like, gosh, there's some kind of novel ideas here. What if they just get copied? You know, it's kind of scary in that way. It has to be scary for new entrepreneurs too, especially if you're going the Kickstarter route.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's a valid concern. On the other hand, that might be your least of your worries, at least of a typical founder's worries is that someone's going to copy you. A bigger worry should be, are people going to want it? And how am I going to get it to users?
That's right.
Which for a lot of people who have no existing audience, or marketing spend, like money to pay for users.
That's a good point. That's a really good point because I've had people also reach out and say, I need you to sign this NDA and they're so protective of their ideas. They actually never go and build it.
Yeah.
So I got to say, I should have mentioned this up front. Congratulations on selling your business. Mm-hmm. Tell me, can you walk me through that real quick? Like what happened there?
Yeah. So it's been just about 2 months now, since we sold Product Hunt to AngelList. And, so going even back to the beginning days, around the same time that I was talking to Gary Tan that I mentioned earlier, I also met with a bunch of other people, and one of them was Naval. And this was leading into kind of considering going into YC and raising our seed round. Naval, CEO of AngelList, we chatted, and I've admired AngelList for a long time. In fact, I was leading into this deal and announcement, I was searching Twitter for me mentioning AngelList. You do that, one, because you want to make sure, did I say anything bad about AngelList ever?
That's amazing.
And then two, just out of curiosity, like how has my relationship or experience with AngelList changed over the years? And I found this tweet years ago, where I used to use AngelList to find products and companies. I would search it and look at its feed because I was just curious. Like I was basically trying to use AngelList as Product Hunt for like product discovery. And AngelList has never been built for that. It's been really focused initially on investors, but then now on the recruiting side as well. But I was using it for a use case that really wasn't optimized for. So there's certainly some inspiration from AngelList to build Product Hunt, because I saw that clearly AngelList wasn't solving this opportunity. It also wasn't, you know, a place for community and people to kind of share and talk about things. Mm-hmm. So going back to conversation with Naval, you know, this was going into our seed round, had a great conversation. He ended up investing in our seed round.
He's a brilliant guy too.
Brilliant guy. He's also, he's wicked smart. He's very futuristic. I don't know if that's a word he'd want me to use to describe him, but he thinks about the future in a very unique way. He's very early in like Bitcoin and thinking through some of those things, and also almost like extrapolating out, like what does the future look like in a decade when we have these emerging technologies solving these different use cases and so on. So super interesting guy. And so he invested then. We've, of course, stayed in touch and everything, and he's been super supportive throughout Product Hunt. And then leading into kind of middle to end of last year, we, you know, were evaluating different options, started talking to Naval more and more. And the opportunity that they're chasing and that we're chasing just made a lot of sense in terms of they're focused on helping companies raise money, helping companies recruit and build an awesome team. And we've been so focused on helping people, companies get users. So if you look at like, those are three challenges that every company faces, and how can we together, you know, have a bigger impact?
Yeah. I mean, the second I heard it, it totally made sense to me. It's like you're very complimentary, but, but not really competitive. So it sounds like it's going to be a good mixture.
Yeah.
What's next for you guys in terms of product? Like, what are you working on now?
Yeah. So we're working on, there's one thing I haven't shared too much about yet, and I'll have to keep it a little bit high level, but historically we focused on here's what's new and cool today in tech. And it's like really the best place to stay up to date and what people are building and to discover things that you never knew existed. And that's great. And we'll continue doing and supporting that. But there's this huge opportunity also in how do we help people find the right product for their need? And we see today on Twitter and elsewhere, people are always asking for recommendations.
Oh, for sure.
So it's like anything from Sunrise, the calendar app is gone. I need a new replacement. What should I download for my iPhone?
Oh, don't bring. Why'd you have to bring that up, man? Sorry. Sunrise was my favorite calendar.
It was great. I know.
It was so good.
There'll be another Sunrise.
You know, I use BusyCal.
I haven't used that.
Oh, it's great. It's my favorite backup to Sunrise. Sunrise, though, a special place in my heart for that.
I feel like it ended too soon in that. Yeah.
Did you see someone launch on Product Hunt another app called Sunrise? Did you see that?
No, I
missed that. And in the comments, people were like, too soon, man. What are you doing? You're using the same name.
Yeah. It's funny. Funny little thing is if you use Product Hunt enough, you may notice the URLs. It has like structured in a way that's /name of the product. Mm-hmm. But if there's a product that has the same name, we just do a -2 or -3, -4.
That's fine.
And you'll see sometimes that there's like a -10 and you'll be like, there are 10 other products with the same name already on Product Hunt today. So you see the same names recycle all the time.
Yeah. Crazy. So that's the focus then, helping people find, cause I was looking for a digital camera. I'm traveling to Japan in a couple weeks and, I wanted a really good camera. There's always something that you need and you're just like, I need a friend. So are we talking like, a lot of people have tried this. This is the tricky thing because, you know, there's been a bunch of different, kind of Q&A platforms, you know, that people have said, okay, ask me something, I'll try and route that question to the right person to get mm-hmm. you relevant responses. Mm-hmm. Biz tried this recently. I mean, that was like kind of Jelly, his yeah. initial with Jelly. Do you think you have a new take on it?
I think part of the challenges with some of the other approaches have been they're so broad, and in many ways, people default to Google because that's where they've been trained to ask questions forever. And Google solves a lot of those use cases. However, they don't solve certain use cases as well as platform specific can. So like, for example, like if you go on Google today and you search for like, what's the best sunrise alternative, you will find answers. You're going to find blog posts from different publications reviewing or suggesting different things, but it may not be the best solution or answer to your contextual specific question. Mm-hmm. It's also structured in a way that requires you to kind of like dig and sift and open up like five tabs. And
right.
That use case is, I think, just not yet solved from Google itself.
Well, and the information once published is already out of date, right? I mean, it's like valid for a couple months and then something new comes out that's even better. So like,
exactly,
that's always been the challenge, right? Like, how do you let this be a living, breathing thing so that your recommendation for the best digital camera is not the one that was out, you know, 6 months ago. It's actually the one that is relevant now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. How do you solve that?
That's something that we will have to figure out. I think a particular question in a series of answers is accurate for only so long. It could be accurate for a year. It could be accurate for a month. And so figuring out a way to keep those recommendations essentially up to date as new products are launched, and also as products change, because mm-hmm. you might think that let's say your opinion of Snapchat, you know, 4 years ago, it's going to be very different than what it is today.
Sure,
that product has evolved substantially, so that's a challenge that we had to solve as well.
Cool. Well, I'm excited. Can I be a beta tester? I'd love to check this stuff out.
I'll send you some wireframes or some mockups that we're working on.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for being on the show. Excited for your future together. I think Angelus and combining you guys is going to be a great combination. So
yeah.
Hopefully we'll have you back on soon when you have something new to launch.
Yeah, absolutely. I think hopefully March we'll have something to show.
Sweet.
We'll see.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. See you later. Cool.
See ya.
Thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Also want to remind you once again, if you haven't signed up for the newsletter, www.thejournal.email, once a month newsletter. Check it out. I know you're going to enjoy it.